In this episode, I'm interviewing Yezin Alerhayem. Yezin is one of the smartest guys I've met in the region. He started White Payments in 2014 after realizing that there were no easy solutions for startups to accept online payments, and White Payments got acquired by Payforward about a year later. His most recent startup, Verify, is a reputation protocol on blockchain, providing protection to both sides of a sale involving cryptocurrencies. Here's the interview. Yezin, welcome to the podcast.
Hey, thanks for having me, Evan.
Sure. Tell us a little bit about yourself, your background. Why did you choose entrepreneurship and all that?
So I come from a computer engineering background. I studied computer engineering at the University of Bahrain and graduated 2007. And at the time, I didn't even think about like startups or any of that jazz. It was really just I wanted to get a job. And so I looked at my options. I'd done like a summer internship at a bank. And so while I considered that, I didn't really look forward to like the prospect of having to work as like a help desk person for a bank, because really, computer engineering is weird. They don't know what to do with you. You're sort of CS, but you're also sort of engineering, but they don't really know what to do with like the combination of hardware and software. So typically you just end up doing, like help desk or, support or whatever it is. So instead I worked at, I applied to this company called GE. They'd come to the career day at the UOB. And so I applied and, I was able to get through. But I actually ended up working in energy. So they didn't do, they don't do like software networks or any of that. So I just sort of switched a little bit into energy and a specific field called instrumentation and control. And essentially what we do is I spent 5 years at GE in varying roles, but the first year was sort of like a graduate management program. You do various rotations. And then I spent 2 years in Saudi Arabia. And in Saudi, I was a systems and instrumentation engineer. We would go out to like power plants or refineries and install this equipment that would monitor critical machinery at the plant. So your turbines, your boilers, your pumps, various large pieces of equipment. And then, it would monitor vibration and temperature and, determine if something's off, if there's something wrong with the machine. So 2 years after doing that, I actually did a black belt role, which is a quality manager role, also at GE. I heard about, this thing called Startup Weekend. And it was like the first time they were ever doing a Startup Weekend in Bahrain. And I never really considered this concept of a startup. I was like, it never even crossed my mind. This seemed like a good opportunity, a good way to spend a weekend. So I went to the Startup Weekend event, and that like changed the trajectory of my career. A few months after the event, I left GE and I started working on, various startup businesses. But that's how I got involved with entrepreneurship, like 5 years into a corporate career.
That's really cool. So you started Canvas.bh, I think, right? And that was one of the companies?
Yeah, the first thing I sort of started working on was a concept called print.bh. Okay. And the idea here was really nothing more than like retaliation for a local print shop. There was this print shop locally where they would just charge ridiculous prices. And I got really pissed off because my sisters at the time were studying at the university and they would print these large posters. So when he came to judge the price, he would basically just look at the poster and then he would throw a random number at you. And I don't know why that really got me angry, because it's like it doesn't make sense. Like how do you come up with this number? You're making numbers up, and just didn't make sense. And, you know, overall, I just thought the process was horrible. You ended up waiting a really long time in order to get your, you know, your printed material. And so I thought, what if this was done online? And so I made a lot of mistakes in that original, you know, startup. I'd left GE without really thinking through what I was going to do. And so this seemed like a good opportunity. A lot of mistakes. Like, I hadn't really thought through the unit economics for, you know, printing online and whether it makes sense and whether, you know, the cost of delivery is going to be much higher than, you know, the material itself, especially if you're printing like A4 and documents. And so, you know, a lot of pain, but, you know, eventually I had to shut down after a few months, and then print.ph sort of morphed into canvas.ph, which was a much better success. It sort of fixed a lot of the broken assumptions that I had made in print.ph.
So you just needed for things to make sense. And I understand what you mean with that, like throwing random numbers at you.
I think from the company perspective, with print.ph, I made several mistakes, but the key ones were, one, you know, we're basically a commodity. You know, you could print anywhere, and now we provided you with the opportunity to print online. And so rather than focusing on printing a commodity, we switched into, okay, you print premium material that is at, like, you know, super high margin versus trying to compete on cost, which is what we were trying to do. Like, it was very elaborate. You know, I actually came up with this algorithm that would analyze the documents that you uploaded, even if they're like multi-page Word documents. It would literally analyze the ink content. So it would analyze the color on the document and then convert that into the actual ink content, and then figure out how much ink it'll consume, and then calculate the cost, and then add a certain margin, and that's what we would charge you. So you upload a document and you instantly get a quote, you know, based on the, you know, specific ink content of the document that you uploaded. So it didn't make sense because we were competing on price. And so we switched from that to charging for a premium product, which is Canvas. So really high product, really high margins, very few competitors. Suddenly, you know, it makes a lot more sense to deliver a product that is premium.
I love it. That's really cool. So what was the startup scene like at that time in Bahrain? When you went to the startup weekend, for example, how many people were there?
Oh, it was, at the time, it just seemed like there were a ton of people. I think we'd use the Batelco Sports Hall in the main Batelco office, and it was full. So I think there were a lot of people, probably like 100 people or more.
Wow, really?
Participants, yeah. So it was huge, and it was just a new world to me, like just seeing people from all walks of life, you know, sort of working over the course of a weekend to get this, you know, this project done. It was amazing.
Oh, that's cool. I didn't expect that answer, honestly. So I'll get to white payments, but before getting to that, I just want to ask, how come Paul Graham is following you on Twitter?
Yeah, I'm not sure myself.
One of the LinkedIn ads, maybe?
No, that actually happened before the LinkedIn experiment. So so I'm not really sure why that's the case. Maybe it's related to, you know, Patrick Collison also following me. It, you know, there's like a shared following. Maybe that's somehow related.
That's really cool. Okay. So tell us a little bit about White Payments. That's when I met you. We met in Dubai for the first time, you'll remember. Mm-hmm. You put up this ad looking for a Rails developer on Stack Overflow. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, got your contact information through that. That's how, you know, we first met. So for people who don't know what White Payments is, what was it about? Why did you start White Payments?
Sure. So after Canvas BH, I just sort of took some time off, and then I went to Iceland and did like this whole month-long bike trip. And I didn't really know what I was going to do next. I was hoping that somehow this trip would, you know, help me figure it out. But I'd come back, and I still didn't know what I was going to do. But yeah, it was a good fun, though, the trip. But anyway, so on my way back, I was still unsure. And then I thought, all right, let me just, you know, try and start some sort of online business. And at the time, it was sort of like pre Uber in the Middle East. Uber sort of existed in the US. But they hadn't really come to the Middle East. There was no Kareem at the time. And so I really like, you know, I noticed it was really hard to get around in Bahrain if you didn't have a car. And so I thought there must be a better way. And, you know, I had this idea for building like an Uber type solution for Bahrain. And so I did what I'd done previously with Canvas BH, which is I just built like a really simple prototype over the course of a weekend. And I thought, all right, let's just create this this simple mobile site where, you know, people can request a ride, and then someone would come pick them up and drop them off wherever they need to go. And basically like an Uber. I'd set it up, and then I set aside like 3 or 4 hours for online payments. I was like, well, you know, it'd probably take like an hour. I was familiar with Stripe and Braintree and a few other solutions in the US, so I didn't think it would take really long. And so I set aside some time to do that. And when I got to that, when I actually built like the basic version and I got to actually integrating payments, I realized what a nightmare it was. In Bahrain, your options are basically going to Credit Max or NBB. But after visiting NBB, you'll realize that, you know, Credit Max is really your only option. And so, you know, you just have to go through this elaborate process where you have to sign a bunch of documents and get a CR and do all these crazy things, jump through hoops. And of course, in order to get the CR at the time, you actually had to rent a place. So imagine like you're trying to build an MVP in like a few hours and suddenly you have to rent a place and get a CR and, you know, sign up for a merchant account. So it's a nightmare. And then I thought maybe it's easier in Dubai because, you know, they're like, you know, high tech and everything. And I'm sure it'd be easier there. But I realized it was actually worse. In Dubai, you had to pay a security deposit for an online business. And the security deposit is to the tune of like $10,000, which I thought was absolutely ridiculous. And so, yeah, that's sort of how I stumbled into online payments. I thought there was a better way to do that. And I'd heard about Stripe and a few other solutions. And the basic concept was, what if we could emulate, you know, that type of solution for the Middle East? Of course, the only problem was I had absolutely no background in credit card payments.
So you scrapped the other idea and started learning about payments?
Yeah. Okay. And so I spent a few weeks just sort of reading through a ton of material, you know, discovering everything that happens from the moment you swipe a card until, you know, the seller gets paid, and acquiring banks, issuing banks, and everything that happens in between. That was a huge learning process. And at the same time, I also realized that in order to get started, we'd actually need acquiring bank partners. So partner up with some sort of bank, so that we can actually process payments. And that's when, you know, the whole process, I started interacting with the various acquiring banks in the UAE and in Bahrain.
So why did you start the company? You started a company in Dubai, is that correct?
Yeah.
So yeah. Why did you choose Dubai? Why not start it in Bahrain?
Well, I think the idea was, we actually, from the moment I had the idea, I'd set up a simple page where people could select a country and drop their email address. So basically allow people to receive updates and, you know, sign up for like a beta. Didn't have a product, didn't have anything, just had a simple site that explained what we wanted to do. And that's it. You can select your country and put your email address. And that informed, you know, some of the decisions around where we'd start early on. Obviously, you know, market-wise, the UAE is much larger than Bahrain or any other country in terms of online payments at the time. You know, if you do a breakdown of the total online payment processing volume, you'll realize the UAE was number one. And so it made sense from a, you know,
market.
If you think about it this way. Yeah, if you think about it this way, like the UAE, you have all this volume being processed through the UAE, despite their process being, you know, horribly inefficient. And so this sort of tells you that there's huge demand, despite the process being so difficult in the UAE, you're seeing such high demand. So imagine what, you know, if you had an optimized process, you imagine how much bigger it could be.
So how did you fund the business? Did you look for any external investment?
Yeah, I did that early on, but I wasn't able to get very far because investors really wanted to see like a banking partner, and banks, they wanted a security deposit of $100,000. And so, yeah, this chicken egg scenario where I couldn't get the money because, you know, investors wanted a bank and I couldn't get the bank because the bank wanted money. So I ended up getting a loan from family and friends, and I was able to fund, you know, at least the first step where we were able to open up sign a banking agreement with the largest acquiring bank in the UAE.
And you developed the MVP yourself, is that correct?
Correct, yeah. Okay. So a basic version of the MVP, you know, the product was really just an API. And an API where you can send card details and we would process the payment. And you would get paid after a set schedule.
But that connects to the bank's API, or how did that go? Because you know it's very dangerous, you know, going through taking people's credit card information and processing that and all that.
Sure. Yeah. So you sort of have to balance everything. The bank actually didn't happen until 9 months later. So it took 9 months of follow up before I was able to get the bank on board.
Wow.
And so in the meantime, I had to validate demand somehow. And so what I did was I patched together various solutions. There's a solution. They're still live. It's called tocheckout.com. And they didn't have an API, but what they did have was like a checkout page. And so I wrote this crawler.
Oh, that sounds fun.
Yeah, it would receive the basic API details, so card number, expiry date, and CVC, and then it would pass those details over to a website that had to checkout integrated into it. This would all happen in the background, you know, the customer they would simply pass the card details to an API, and then all this, you know, would fire up a browser, you know, go to this website that had to checkout integrated, process the transaction, and then return the response, and then parse that response and return it in, you know, a JSON format to the requester. And so that's how you're able to process like the first $10,000 or so.
That's really cool.
Yeah, to validate demand for, you know, the product before we actually ended. You know, the bank only happened way later. That's how the beginning worked.
So after setting up all this, you had some issues with the bank. They stopped the processing without notifying you. So could you tell us about that story?
Yeah. So 9 months later, and you know, this 9 months was horrible because, you know, coming into it, you don't really realize how long it's going to take. It was always just, you know, one more step left before you'd be live, and I would just constantly follow up with the bank. And then eventually, you know, 9 months later, when we actually went live, we started processing like crazy. I think the general expectation was that we wouldn't be able to get very far by the bank. You know, they were thinking, okay, you know what, this guy's been bugging us for 9 months. Let's just put the account live and see what happens. And so, you know, we were able to hit six figures fairly quickly. And we had, I think what happened was, there was huge interest. So we were able to, we had a backlog of several thousand leads, through the website. So we set up the website from the very beginning, from day one, and we were collecting leads all along. And as we were putting people live, we'd only put up like, I think it was 20 or 30 merchants before we hit six figures. And so as we were working through the list, it became very clear that we were going to get a lot of volume very quickly. We were having discussions with the bank about, you know, what scaling would look like, you know, what the process looks like. We basically had checkpoints with the bank where we said, all right, once we hit certain volume, you know, we're going to have sort of like a makeshift audit with the bank. And that's what we did. So everything, you know, the process was going pretty well. Customers were happy. And, you know, response times were pretty quick. We were getting people paid when they were expected to get paid. And suddenly, you know, when they wake up and see a bunch of errors and realize the account had been shut down by the bank. And we were sending requests to the bank's API, but we were not getting responses. And then I spoke to the bank and realized that, you know, they had like an executive meeting and they decided that they were not going to deal with payment aggregators, which is, you know, what we were at the time.
Nice.
Yeah. So that was quite so we were sort of sandwiched between the merchants, which were, you know, just calling me constantly, and the bank, which was ignoring my calls constantly. And so that was a very stressful time.
I can't even imagine. It's I have a lot of questions regarding white payments, but you know, I will just skip them. Just one last question. So you guys were acquired by Payfort. How was that process?
So at the time we were considering all options as far as actually continuing to process. And so, you know, one suggestion came up. I'd actually met Omar from Payfort before, and it was through like various events and conferences that happened. It's a pretty small space, so we know all of the players. And so I actually met them, and then he seemed like a decent guy. So, you know, we had a few conversations, and you know, when it came time to actually continue processing, we opened up a discussion with them about actually processing payments through Payfort. So, you know, Payfort's already got connections with certain banks. Maybe we can use that connection in order to process payments through Payfort. Everybody benefits. You know, we get to focus on the technology, and, you know, they get increased transaction volume, and, you know, the bank's happy. So everybody's happy. But, you know, it quickly became clear from, you know, from their perspective that, you know, if they were going to get involved, then they would have to acquire the company. And discussions quickly veered that way. We were considering other options as well. But, you know, later when it came time to make a decision, we just thought, all right, you know, here's an opportunity to partner with the largest payment processor in the region. They do north of $1 billion a year in processing. And so imagine like the possibilities where it just seemed like a perfect fit, because we were focused on like the tail end of the market, small, medium sized business. That's where we, you know, we developed this process where we're able to onboard people within under 5 minutes versus their existing client base, which was, you know, governments, large airlines, and very large customers. And so it was very complimentary. And yeah, it made sense.
So after White Payments, you moved to London after a while, right?
Mm-hmm.
So why London? Why did you choose to move to London?
I mean, there are various reasons. I wanted to work remotely. We had a remote team at the time, so me being in like the head office, just sort of, it's different. If I'm based in Dubai and where like the rest of the company is, and, you know, we had a team based in Belarus, and, you know, we're hiring people in various places. So, I thought it was a good opportunity to, you know, just step away from the scene and, you know, just take the opportunity to work remotely in different places. And London was a great place, for me, because it's like, you know, the fintech scene, there are a lot of fintech startups in London. And also, my wife at the time was studying. And so she had been accepted to a UK university. So it just made sense for both of us.
Yeah. Okay. I see. So let's talk about Verify, your current company, current startup. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about it.
Sure. So, where to start? I'm not really sure how to explain like how everything started, because it all happened so quickly. I think Verify, like the early version of Verify, I'd heard, you know, at the time when, you know, white payments, and later at Payforward, I'd heard a lot about blockchain and Bitcoin, not Ethereum yet. I think Ethereum was way too small back then, but, you know, blockchain and Bitcoin, and I'd been hearing about quite a bit. And so, you know, it was just sort of back of my mind, never really thought much about it. Back in June last year, it reached a point where I'd already left Payforward, and I was looking at various things to do. I was working on, you know, various sort of side projects, just taking the time to sort of delve into various creative ventures. Really random things. as we, you know, we may get to that in a bit of time, if we have any time left at the end of this call. So I thought, hey, this is really interesting. I'd heard about blockchain, but I never really had the opportunity to sort of learn a lot about it. And so I started reading up on Ethereum specifically. I'd put a bit of money in Ethereum when it was super tiny. It was like $20. And so I was seeing it grow, and I thought, hey, this is super interesting. Maybe I should learn a bit more about it. And I'm just very curious by nature. I love learning. And so I ran this experiment where I was like, all right, let me try to start my own. You know, there were a lot of ICOs running at the time. And so I thought, you know, maybe I can create my own one and just sort of test it out, you know, see how this process actually works. It seemed like a great learning experiment for me. And so in June, that's what I did. I thought, let me try and run an ICO. And, you know, to keep things grounded, I put like 10 days. I was like, let me put 10 days down and try to see how much I can learn within 10 days. If I can launch my own sort of ICO in 10 days.
But at that time, this was not Verify yet, right?
This was not
a different company. This was the you know, non-centralized VC idea.
Exactly.
Okay.
This was just a random idea. I was like, all right, let me try, you know, doing this ICO thing. And so I did. And in the process, I learned a ton about like how Ethereum works, how smart contracts work, how sort of everything works from a process perspective in terms of raising funds, you know, getting people involved, marketing, you know, how you get all of those things together in order to create sort of like a project. So that initial ICO failed. I was trying to raise $1 million and I raised like 15,000. And so it failed by that metric, but I was certainly able to learn a lot. And so later, you know, after I stopped this idea, I was thinking about, you know, Ethereum and how, you know, we could address some of the bigger problems. Is ultimately, you know, coming back to white payments and Payforward, I think the biggest challenge we've faced since starting and, you know, since then, like even after, it's always been like, you know, you're trying to move a certain pace and you can't move faster than the slowest piece of, you know, this value chain. And that's often banks or regulators. So banks or central banks or, you know, some sort of regulatory body that needs to approve whatever it is you're doing. And so this usually grounds you to a halt. If you get shut down by a bank, or, you know, if a bank decides only to allow you to onboard like 10 merchants a month, then that's what you're going to do. That's it. There's really nothing else you can do about it. And so, you know, that's what was really appealing to me about Ethereum and blockchain in general, because you didn't have that central element. You didn't have banks slowing you down. So yeah, I thought about that a lot, and I thought about the payments challenges that we have in the region, and I thought about, you know, combining the two and figuring out a solution where, you know, you're able to take the best of blockchain and Ethereum and apply them to real world problems. And that's how Verify came to be.
So tell us a little bit about what Verify is actually doing, what you guys are working on.
Sure. So So you can think of Verify as sort of like a PayPal for the crypto world, just vaguely. Essentially, what we do is we allow buyers and sellers to transact using in the crypto world. And the way we do that is using reputation. So today, when you're trying to buy, or on the flip side of that transaction, when you're trying to sell something using crypto, then there's an inherent trust in the counterparty. So as a buyer, if you're trying to buy, say, a hat online, okay, if you send Bitcoin or Ethereum or any other crypto to the seller, then you trust the seller to deliver the item later. So after you've paid, there's an expectation that you're going to, the seller is going to ship you some sort of item. If they don't, then there's no recourse. There's nothing you can do. You can't go to a bank and tell them, hey, this guy never sent me my stuff, because there is no bank. And so this is increasingly in a decentralized future. There's going to be increasingly, a need for some sort of way to resolve such conflicts, or, to mediate transactions without relying on trust. And so that's what we provide. We think the solution there is through reputation, and we call it reputation, but reputation is essentially a record of all transactions that you've participated in the past, and the feedback on those transactions. So you can think about every action that you take online having either a positive or a negative impact on your score. Think of like a GPA that gets updated with every transaction that you participate in online. And that score is, what is used to determine, how fast you get paid, whether funds are held in escrow or they are released immediately. And so this is sort of like the concept of building. The short form for Verify is Verify is a reputation protocol on the blockchain. So we create this reputation score based on transaction history on the blockchain.
Sounds like a great idea. How about the competitive space for that specific idea?
There are various bits and pieces, and there are various players in each part. But I think the whole place is just so nascent that it's really irrelevant. Even if you have like 5 or 6 different players doing payments or doing a specific type of payments, then that's okay, because there's a really high chance that, 3/4 of them are just going to disappear, because these are just the normal stats for startups. So we're okay with that, with those odds. I think execution, it's all about execution. The idea really doesn't matter. You can have 5 people, working on the same idea, but they have various levels of execution, and that's going to determine, who's going to succeed and who is not.
Definitely agree. So you guys had a successful ICO recently. ICO for anyone who doesn't know what it is, it's called initial coin offering, and you allow people to buy the cryptocurrencies that you guys are providing. Is that correct?
Yeah, we call it a token sale. From a purely like, so we try and avoid this parallel with investing or buying stocks, because they're not stocks. Or investments, we call it a token sale, because we generate these tokens that are utility tokens. So you buy them beforehand, and the idea is that once we build the platform, then you'll be able to use those tokens in order to do stuff on the platform. We call it a token sale.
And how much did you guys sell in the ICO?
So we'd raised $2.5 million in just under 90 minutes.
That's amazing. How is it compared to other recent ICOs? I know you're very into, quantifying things and, assessing performance. How is it compared to other ICOs?
I think it varies a lot depending on, so many things. I think what happened is, when ICOs sort of first started, there was huge interest, and there was a lot more money than there was like projects to put it in. And so people were generally raising higher and higher caps. So a cap is, you know, the limit that you set for a fundraise. And so, or, you know, for this token sale.
Did you guys?
And so initially it was really high, and people were just raising hundreds of millions of dollars, and it made absolutely no sense. For us, like we originally set out to raise 15 million, but then we quickly realized, like, you know, that's a lot of money to be raising very early on, especially since, you know, you're really at the concept stage. You're trying to get to like an MVP or like an initial version of your vision that you can, you know, start to get revenue on. And so it just didn't seem right. So we restructured everything, and we set the hard cap at 2.5 mil, even though like we actually had over $7.5 million in commitments. Like, we set up a form where people can say, all right, this is how much I'm willing to commit before we opened up the token sale. And we actually had over $7.5 million in commitments. And so once we opened up the token sale, that's why, you know, it blew up that quickly in under 90 minutes. This is in under 90 minutes of not a public sale, but a sale where we'd capped it to about 500 participants, and every participant was whitelisted. Like, if your address was not on a certain list, then you would not be able to, we would just return the funds that you send. And so we had a bunch of people sending funds, and they weren't on the list, and they would just get rejected. And so this is 2.5 million of, you know, people that are whitelisted and, you know, had been pre-approved to participate in the token sale.
That's definitely great. It's an interesting form of validation. So I guess you guys expected to sell out in 90 minutes, as, you know, you had $7.5 million that people said that they were going to commit, right? Or were you guys surprised?
So I don't know. Like, so we'd actually, you know, prior to the token sale, we were sort of discussing like what our expectations were. And, I think even in the wildest expectations, we weren't expecting to be done in under like 2 days, because these are ridiculous sums of money you're talking about. $2.5 million. Like, what? I did not expect it. And we were running a live stream at the time, so you can see, like, just by our facial expressions, this was nuts. We actually had this progress bar on the website. And, you know, this progress bar would update and, you know, to show, you know, what percentage of funds was raised. And so we'd set it up like I think the token sale started at 5 p.m. Here in Bahrain. And so we set it up at 5 p.m. And then we were just sort of blabbering on the live stream. And then it was like 5:03. It was like, hey, let me refresh this. So I refreshed the page, and it's like more than halfway through. And I was like, what? There must be a bug. That was the first thing that I was thinking about. There must be a bug in, you know, this stupid progress bar. I must have screwed it up. And then I actually checked Etherscan, and lo and behold, we'd already raised like $1 million in under 10 minutes.
That's amazing. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Yazin, I have so many questions to ask, and I can just do it for I don't know how long, but, you know, we're at the end of 40 minutes that we set for this. So I want to be respectful to your time, but I'm hoping that, you know, we can do a part two to this in the near future.
Sure, I'd love to. I certainly hope so. I think this is a great initiative, and I hope to see it continue.
Thank you. I really appreciate it. Thanks again for taking the time. And just before we close, could you share how people can reach you on the internet?
Sure. So I have a site. It's yaz.in that redirects to yazin.org. And I'm also active on Twitter. So Yazin Sai, YAZINSAI. Those are the two best channels to reach me on.
By the way, I recommend anything Yazin writes. You know, it's just he writes amazing. And if you're into startups at all, you should definitely go read his blogs. So,
thank you.
Thank you. thank you for taking the time again, and take care.
All right, cheers. Bye-bye.
Thanks a lot for listening to this episode of the Startups Middle East podcast. You can see the show notes and find out more about the podcast at startupsmiddleeast.com. If you like this episode, I'd love for you to subscribe, rate, or give a review on iTunes. Until next time.